In this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Jason Schooley and Adam Geik, two biologists conducting a wide range of research projects focusing on paddlefish in Oklahoma. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, at Fisheries Pod, or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Today we are joined by two guests. Jason D. Schooley was born and raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He received his bachelor's in zoology from Oklahoma State University in 2002. After graduating, he worked in the Arizona State University Native Fishes Lab with Dr. Paul Marsh and Dr. Tom Dowling, monitoring and restoring numerous native and imperiled desert fishes. In 2008, he began his master's degree at Arizona State, focusing on evaluating restoration stocking success for the endangered razorback sucker. In 2009, he joined the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife and Conservation, working part-time at the Paddlefish Research Center. He was then hired as a paddlefish biologist in 2010 and promoted to senior biologist in 2018. And he was nice enough to rope in one of his co-workers, Adam Geik. Adam grew up on the banks of the Tippecanoe River in northern Indiana and worked for the Indiana DNR during the summer months. He also lived for 15 years in Bozeman, Montana, where he received his bachelor's degree in organismal biology from Montana State University in 2010, while also working summer jobs with both Wyoming and Montana. Adam returned to the central U.S. to obtain his master's degree from Arkansas Tech University in 2016. While there, he studied paddlefish movements on Lake Dardanelle. And for the second week in a row, I will be interviewing someone who beat me out for a job, as Adam was hired as a paddlefish biologist in 2016, working at the Paddlefish Research Center in Miami, Oklahoma. Both Jason and Adam are active in the American Fisheries Society on the national, divisional, and state level, the Mississippi Interstate Cooperative Resource Association Paddlefish and Sturgeon Committee, and the North American Sturgeon Paddlefish Society, where Jason serves on the governing board. Though they both spend the majority of time and effort managing paddlefish in Oklahoma, they enjoy expanding their horizons with issues facing sturgeons, gars, bowfin, and other native species. Welcome to the podcast, Jason and Adam.
Thanks for having us, Nick. Very humbling experience to be invited to participate in this. I've been a fan since you first started this thing, so it's pretty cool to be invited to talk with you today.
Well, thank you. You were on the short list when I first came up with the idea, or first decided to go forth with the idea of the podcast, so the pleasure is also mine to be interviewing you.
Thank you.
So both of you work heavily with paddlefish in Oklahoma. In case there is someone listening who hasn't seen one, either in person or in pictures, would either one of you mind describing the paddlefish before we get started?
Well, the paddlefish is really a bizarre species. They're unlike any other freshwater species that comes to mind. They're sort of cousins to the sturgeon. They've been around for 65, 70 million years. They're large bodied. They can easily exceed 100 pounds in weight. But what makes them most interesting and distinct is the fact that on the front end of their head, they have something called a rostrum, or as it's named, a paddle. And they use that rostrum to detect electrical currents generated by, you know, very small freshwater zooplankton, and that serves as their primary food source. So they are a filter feeding organism. They only eat zooplankton and their freshwater, and they pretty much swim around all day scooping plankton out of the water, growing really big, and they make pretty massive upstream migrations in springtime to spawn. Another thing about them is that they're great to catch. They're a big fish. They're great to eat because their flesh is largely boneless. They have mostly a cartilage skeleton. And they're like the sturgeon, their cousin, their roe are prized as caviar. So salted roe is a delicacy, and their caviar demand a pretty high price.
I think it's worth adding too that along with what Jason was saying about them being bizarre, they're the only extant species within the family Polydontidae, but even within that, they're quite a bit different from most of the other species. If you go back and look at the fossil record, most of them sort of have that typical sturgeon mouth, kind of a sucker mouth on the bottom, but the current species of paddlefish they have a, you know, the filtering apparatus, and that's probably a big reason why they're still around today.
Yeah, technically they'd be called a midwater planktivore, but like he said, the Chinese paddlefish, which is largely extinct, is a piscivore. So this is the only midwater planktivore in Polyodon.
So if there is any one fish to be cartooned as a superhero, I would think it would be the paddlefish. They have a variety of special adaptations that have helped them survive for millions of years. And you mentioned one of them, the ability to electrosense their food. Would either one of you mind talking about any of their other special powers? Their natural sunscreen, rostrum, skeletal structure, their filtering abilities, or their super healing?
You mentioned their super healing, and that's a good question, Nick. We see a lot of paddlefish, sort of given the habitats that they prefer. Open water type of stuff makes them susceptible to getting hit by boat props. They're on these large river systems that have a lot of dams with turbines, so they're prone to getting hit by those. And it's fairly frequent that we will see paddlefish with extensive injuries to the flesh and to the rostrum, to the points of, some of them are fairly grotesque, but the fish seem to persist on, and we do see a lot of fish with quite a bit of scarring. I think the most recent one I saw maybe had 5 or 6 fully healed scars down one of its sides from apparently a boat prop, and there were probably 8 to 10 inch gashes on the side. And pretty amazing that they can survive that type of stuff, but they've been around for so long that their immune system, I think, has got to be pretty incredible to deal with, the environment that they live in.
Yeah, and there's been a little bit of research on this. There's actually a paper, I can't remember the author, but it's been out for several decades, and it's titled The Integument of the Paddlefish, which in and of itself is a great paper title, but they described a thicker than average and a more active layer of leukocytes in their skin. That it's interesting that paddlefish pretty much are scaleless, and they're not very slimy compared to a lot of the scaled fish that we're used to. So they don't have those protective scales, and they don't necessarily have quite the active slime layer that you get on other fish, which is also protective. However, they're able to survive these ghastly wounds that we see, not only just from hooks, just through the act of catching them, but like Adam said, going through a dam turbine where their entire rostrum gets cut off, or they get hit by a boat or shot with an arrow, et cetera. And we even find some unlucky fish that have encountered all of these things. And somehow they survive. They're able to heal their flesh and carry on and keep living. So they are one of the hardiest fish I've ever seen.
And you guys have some collaborative projects currently going on, looking into not only the consequences of rostrum amputation, but also the natural sunscreen or the natural resistance to sunburn that some of these paddlefish have. So what have you and your collaborators learned about some of these special characteristics of the paddlefish?
Firstly, the sunscreen thing is in such the infancy that we don't really have a whole lot of context just yet. It was kind of something that we collaborated with Dr. Paul Long at King's College in London, where we collected some tissue samples, and for some reason he had a suspicion that maybe these fish have some kind of derivatives of natural sunscreen. And through the tissue samples we provided, he was able to confirm that. And I don't have the technical information to share with you, but he was successful in finding that. So it sort of makes us wonder, what other abilities or qualities does the paddlefish have as a kind of a model organism? And, what can we learn from paddlefish through management the way we're doing it now?
If you've ever seen a paddlefish from clear water compared to a paddlefish that exists in turbid water, like we see fish that get raised at a hatchery in clear water, and they're very dark gray, real dark fish. But the wild fish that we encounter are typically a lot lighter. So I think that was one of the big tip-offs.
Yeah, and even between river paddlefish and reservoir paddlefish, where we typically, at least in Oklahoma, our rivers are a little bit clearer than our reservoirs, which are turbid. You showed me a paddlefish from a river, I could tell you it's a river paddlefish just due to the coloration and the body shape, whereas the reservoir paddlefish are a lot more robust and lighter in color. So yeah, like Adam's saying, that observation may have led to the inquiry on whether or not they have natural sunscreens, because the coloration they take on based on their environment.
You mentioned paddlefish as a model organism or model species. You mentioned in an email to me that there is some work other people are working on looking at their rostrum skeletal structure to develop military vehicles. What could you tell us about that?
Their rostrum skeleton is, again, fairly bizarre and unique. It actually consists of a kind of a bony lattice work. And that's due to the fact that in the spaces between the support structure, that's where all of their electrosensory organs are housed. The ampullae of Lorenzini, which is the same thing you see on marine sharks. And so that lattice work provides a very lightweight but rigid structure to support those numerous functions. I believe the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has done some research looking at the paddlefish rostrum bony structure and how it could be potentially used, what can be learned from it, and how it has evolved in developing some lightweight military body armor or vehicle armor. So again, paddlefish serving as kind of an interesting research specimen where, you know, technology is following natural structures and natural evolution.
You mentioned a little earlier about that these paddlefish are, you often find them with their rostrums chopped off and all these scars, and you guys have a study that you're currently working on looking at the consequences of rostrum amputation. How are having these stubby paddlefish affecting their ability to feed and survive?
Like Adam implied, they can get injured in a number of ways. As far as the rostrum is concerned, primarily it's either through some kind of dam passage impact or from a boat propeller. Most often, you do see higher frequencies of rostrum injuries or amputations in tailwater stocks. So that sort of lends to the hypothesis that amputations are being caused through dam passage. There's also research that indicates that they don't actually have to get physically lopped off by a turbine, that their rostrum at a certain place at the junction between the rostrum and the head is sensitive to breakage just due to the sheer forces of water currents. So in the turbulent waters below a dam, they could be receiving these rostrum injuries just the same as if they passed through the dam. Well, one of the things that interested me and our shop and probably many other paddlefish biologists across the range is what happens when they get their rostrum injured, because that's a fairly critical component to how they find prey using electrosense. It's also important for maintaining their position in the water column, because as you might imagine, that blade sticking out of the front of their head changes their hydrodynamics, especially when they have a large open filter feeding mouth, which is dragging them down. So we wanted to look at several things, and this is an ongoing project, but we've collected data on paddlefish and the incidence of rostrum injuries and amputations in numerous stocks throughout Oklahoma and in Arkansas. And some of the early conclusions we've come to is that it can have population level consequences, because a lot of their reproductive dynamics, including how much they accumulate and are able to generate roe, also how far they migrate to spawn, are related to the amount of resources they're able to get through foraging. And if you have a amputated or injured rostrum, then you have a reduced ability to forage appropriately, which causes you to not build up quite as much gonadal fat bodies, which are actually fatty deposits surrounding the gonads of both males and female paddlefish. Those serve as energy reserves throughout their lifespan. And there's been correlations drawn between gonadal fat deposit size and fish age, of course, but also migratory distance. So it kind of follows that if fish suffered a rostrum amputation and therefore can't eat as much food as it would like because it can't find it, and there it also has difficulty maintaining its position in the water column or in the current because it's harder to swim without a rostrum, and they don't migrate as far. Therefore, on a population level, you could see some impact where rostrum amputation is more common. So these are some of the things and the questions that we're looking into in Oklahoma and surrounding states through collaboration with our neighbors in Arkansas.
So Oklahoma does paddlefish a little bit differently than others. Adam, would you mind discussing a little bit about the work that goes on at the Paddlefish Research Center and how that work affects all the other paddlefish management going on in Oklahoma?
We're real fortunate in Oklahoma to have a number of very healthy paddlefish stocks. And if you look historically, you know, before a lot of these dams were built, there probably wasn't a whole lot of paddlefish. They were there, but probably not in real high numbers. But once a lot of dams started getting built in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and later, what that really does is recreates the ideal habitat for a paddlefish, which is the backwater oxbow lake of a larger river. So you dam these rivers, you create this ideal habitat, and the paddlefish population, assuming that there's still some fish there, the paddlefish that are there, those populations are really going to take off. So we've got a number of reservoirs in the eastern third or so of the state that do have real strong stocks. And because of that, we're able to provide a lot of angling opportunity for, you know, our anglers within our state as well as around the country. People come in from Coeur d'Alene to take a crack at a large fish, you know, potentially the largest freshwater fish that they're going to catch in their entire lives. One thing that we do have that's nearly unique is our caviar program, which is based on a program that was started in Montana and North Dakota above Lake Sakakawea. And what we do is anglers can bring in their fish that they catch. It's completely voluntary. If they want to just keep it, they can do that. But if they decide to bring it to us, the agreement is that we take the data off of the fish and then we process it into fillets, and we get the fillets back to the anglers. And then also, if it's a female fish with viable roe, then we produce caviar and use the funds from the caviar to go back into not just the paddlefish research and stuff, but into our entire department. So it's really kind of a win-win-win. You know, the fish get good management. We get a lot of data. I mean, we've got a huge data set. And then the anglers get their fish clean for free, which it's not real easy. You know, you've got a 60, 70, 80 pound fish, and, you know, you're only catching them once or twice a year. So it's not like you can really practice at it a lot. So taking that, you know, burden of cleaning the fish, and it's more like butchering a larger animal because they're so big. You know, that the anglers seem to like that quite a bit. So it's been a real good program, and it's helped us not only to collect that data, but to sort of raise the social status of paddlefish that, you know, weren't real highly regarded for a long time, but now it's sort of turned around and it's a point of pride within the community.
I'll just add that paddlefish angling in Oklahoma has really boomed since we really started looking at the species and the fisheries in Oklahoma. We've seen a dramatic increase in the issuance of paddlefish permits, and we estimate the number of active paddlefish anglers. And we've seen between the period 2008 and 2015, we saw a 67% increase in paddlefish angling in Oklahoma. And like Adam said, it's simply due to the fact that anglers were now participating in management. They understand that we're managing the species as responsibly as we possibly can. They're providing data for us, and we're providing a service to them which also recruits anglers into the fishery, because we're telling them how to do it. We've taken the burden of what to do with the fish when they catch it, and we've educated them on the fact that paddle fish in Oklahoma actually exist. Many people had no idea what they were in 2008, and we've promoted this fishery, and it's paid dividends to the state as well. We did an economic analysis of Oklahoma paddlefish snagging, and we found that it supported 193 jobs, providing hundreds of thousands of dollars in state sales tax revenues, in addition to a statewide annual economic impact of $18.2 million. So that's pretty significant to us, the fact that this self-sustaining stock of paddlefish in Oklahoma has garnered that much economic impact to our state through tourism dollars. Like Adam said, we're attracting anglers from across the United States. I think we have all but three or four states represented for paddlefish anglers from across the U.S.
So you mentioned the Paddlefish Research Center and the paddlefish fisheries have attracted a lot of anglers to the state. And the caviar that you extract from their fish has allowed you and others to do a variety of projects, including a handful that involve tracking their movements. What kind of information have you learned about their spawning habitats, the effects of snagging, and the habitat use of both adults and age zero fish in Oklahoma?
Given that we are running a program which is sort of based on the fact that anglers are targeting large, mature fish, it was important to us to understand a little bit more about the local reproductive dynamics of paddlefish in Oklahoma. We've seen quite a few telemetry projects happening in other stocks, in other rivers, other states. And what we found out was that some of those conclusions didn't really apply in our stocks. And key lesson we learned is that our paddlefish in Northeast Oklahoma are willing and able to spawn every year if the conditions allow it. Now, this contrasts with other states across the range where they've found that paddlefish exhibit something common in sturgeon as well called skip spawning, where they may have a spawning interval of 1 to 3 to, in some places, maybe up to 5 years between spawning attempts. But what we find in Oklahoma is that based on the information from tracking female fish for 4 consecutive years, we found that Oklahoma paddlefish are willing and able to spawn on an annual basis. So that's really important because that allows the support of our program. We don't have a lot of fish being harvested that have an intermediate stage of maturity of roe. We have them, they're either immature or they're mature. And seeing that in other states, I think, is fairly uncommon. But that was a nice thing to conclude for paddlefish here in Oklahoma. So we see the females mature at about 8 years of age. And if they're over 8, they're pretty much full of eggs come springtime. So that was kind of an interesting observation that we don't see in other states. We did a sort of a less official project. It was actually sponsored by NatureWorks. But in 2010, I believe, we changed the regulation to require catch and release only 2 days a week on Mondays and Fridays. And that was an attempt to kind of temper the harvest that we were seeing from non-residents over a 4-day weekend. So as you can imagine, if Mondays and Fridays are catch and release only, and a lot of our anglers come in for a long weekend, then we could make a pretty significant impact on harvest, the weekend harvest. So we made Mondays and Fridays catch and release only, where harvest is not allowed. However, you can continue catching paddlefish all you want. So it was important to us to demonstrate what are the effects of catch and release on paddlefish. Does it disrupt their spawning movements? Does it cause mortality? Does it cause substantial injuries, etc.? We kind of alluded to this earlier when we were talking about paddlefish in general, but what we saw was through putting tags on fish that were caught and released is that it may have disrupted their movements for a very short time, as in a couple hours to a day, but almost immediately every fish that we tagged after having been caught and released, basically jumped right back into the mix with all the other fish. We saw fish make major movements. We saw fish return to the snagging area within hours to days, get caught again. We even had some fish caught multiple times, and it did not disrupt their drive to migrate and spawn. We also found no evidence of delayed mortality or immediate mortality. And then simply as a follow-up, over the course of the program, after we made that regulation change, we've continued to monitor the presence of hook scars, which are healed hook wounds from the previous snagging season, which are quite common on all the fish we see, which again indicates that this is a hardy fish. It's able to sustain multiple catch and release attempts and continue on and heal up, and it doesn't seem to impact their livelihood in any way. We're also interested in looking at the impacts of catch and release at Fort Gibson Dam, and maybe Adam can talk about that.
Yeah. One of the big aspects of the release condition of these fish is the water temperature. So paddle fish are typically only available to anglers during their spring spawning run when water temperatures are relatively cool. And what we see in the literature is, at least with netting, you know, once water temps get over about 50 Fahrenheit or so, paddle fish become more susceptible to mortality. And again, that's from netting, but you'd expect a similar thing to occur with snag angling. So, you know, I think a lot of the impacts are negated by the water being cooler. And Jason mentioned our fishery at Fort Gibson Dam, and it's a little bit different because for some reason the fish are there, the paddle fish are there into the summer some years. So, you know, that's something that we're currently looking into. We don't have a lot of results yet, but, you know, if fish were to get caught at higher water temperatures and released, you know, what are the effects of that? Definitely something we've got on our radar.
You guys have also been able to do a fair bit of work trying to distinguish these populations. Jason, you mentioned that you could tell the difference between a river and a reservoir fish. You've also used some genetic assessments and looking at body morphology and even some microchemistry information. Would you mind telling us a little bit more about these projects and the information you're learning?
Yeah, among those three examples you gave, only one of them, the genetics work, has been completed at this point. So I can start with that. We were interested in several things. Firstly, our main stock that is the bread and butter of paddlefish research in Oklahoma is the Grand Lake stock, which has natural access to spawning in its headwater rivers in Kansas and Missouri. What we have also observed in that stock is what we call extreme episodic recruitment. Now, paddlefish are long-lived. In Oklahoma, our max age we've seen is 29 years old, but in other stocks in northern latitudes, they'll live twice that long, their age up to 60. So over that long lifespan, like I said, they mature at 8 years old for females. They're going to have numerous opportunities to spawn. However, they're subject to ecological conditions. Therefore, they're not going to spawn necessarily every year, and the hatch may not be successful every year due to different hydrological issues. We can go into more detail on that. But so the result of that is you have a very boom and bust reproductive cycle. Some years there's no spawn whatsoever because there's a drought. Some years there's flooding and the conditions are perfect and you have just an absolute population explosion. We saw that in Grand Lake in 1999. And that giant cohort has really been supporting the fishery ever since. But one of the key questions we had is, what are the genetic impacts on a stock when you have such extreme episodic recruitment? Are all those fish in 1999, are they all siblings? Did we just have a few fish that spawned successfully? Or was it a population-wide impact where it's going to have, you know, effects for generations to come? Well, what we found was there was no risk to the stock. We saw very similar levels of allelic diversity across cohorts, no matter if it was a tiny cohort or a gigantic cohort. So that really told us that we had some healthy reproductive dynamics going on. The fish live a long time. They're able to spawn multiple times in their life, even given that they're subject to these very discrete hydrological conditions. And having a giant year class doesn't necessarily skew the genetics in one direction or another. our second project that we did was doing somewhat of a statewide inventory of paddlefish genetics. And the point of that was to identify genetic management units within our state. Do we need to be managing certain reservoirs as a genetic unit? Are they similar enough based on the timing of dam closures or past stocking practices or actual stocking from outside sources? Does that cause us to have distinct genetic units of paddlefish within Oklahoma? And what we found was that, yes, those are the case. We have three different genetic management units in Oklahoma, and there's actually a paper coming out pretty soon that describes this in fair detail. So I don't want to go into too much of it, but what that's done is simply informed us on how do we need to manage these reservoir stocks as part of a larger genetic stock, which may be separated by dams or watersheds based on, you know, where the fish in a particular reservoir come from, or have they been influenced through stocking. So genetics are a big part of our current and future management in Oklahoma, and we have the ability to make regulatory changes relevant to those genetic management units based on some of the verbiage we've put in our state statutes.
Then you had two ongoing projects going on. One, you're looking at the body morphology using digital photography, and then you're using a newer technique, microchemistry. What have you learned from that so far?
Well, the microchemistry project is it's a new partnership we have with Dr. Whitledge at Southern Illinois University. As your listeners may not know, paddlefish are aged by the use of dentary bones. That's the lower jaw bone. Extracting otoliths out of the skull of a paddlefish for a professional like we are is not that big a deal, but it's buried pretty deep in the head and it can take several minutes to do, even if you're good at it. However, removing a jawbone from a paddlefish takes mere seconds. And so that's the age structure that we remove at the Paddlefish Research Center because, you know, we're in kind of a fish cleaning data collection processing motion. And so we pull dentary bones out. Well, just like an otolith, dentary bones have growth annular rings. And using microchemistry, we can simply, I'm not the pro, Dr. Whitledge would do this, but using lasers, we can look at each annulus and determine what were the chemical conditions that fish was living in as it put that extra layer of bone on the dentary bone. And the relevance of this is when you're in a reservoir stock or elsewhere in the range, and you have multiple options in which to be born or to spawn, such as in Grand Lake, where we have multiple headwater rivers with very distinct chemical compositions. We can use dentary microchemistry to not only determine from which river does a paddlefish originate, but also where was it caught at the time that dentary was removed? And also, is it going back to the same river in which it was hatched? So is there any kind of site fidelity? What is the reproductive output of each river based on, you know, the year that fish was hatched, et cetera? So we have a whole lot of context there, and it plays into the way we're managing the stock and the regulations we have on each river. So it's really kind of a complex interweaving of ideas and hopeful conclusions. But we aim to kick that project off in earnest this spring. So hopefully I'll have more information to share at a later date. But right now it's hasn't produced any results just yet.
A little more specifically, Grand Lake in northeastern Oklahoma is situated in a pretty neat spot. We're kind of at the edge of the Ozarks. Ozarks are to the east, and then if you look west, it's tall grass prairie plains, basically. And the very top of Grand Lake, we've got an Ozark River coming in, the Spring River, and we've also got the Neosho River, which is more of a prairie type of river. And there's, I think we both have a lot of questions about, you know, which one of these river types is better, or, you know, which one gets utilized more often. And I know I'm real excited to sort of dive into some of those very specific answers to tell us, you know, hey, we've got these two very different rivers, and which one's, you know, given the season and the flooding and what have you, you know, what's the real very best conditions for the paddlefish.
I'll just add one more thing, that all of our research that we do on paddlefish in Oklahoma, the objective is to address questions that are relevant to managing the resource. So as Adam described, which of these rivers, the Spring or the Neosho, is more important for paddlefish reproduction and recruitment in Northeast Oklahoma? We're managing those rivers very different in regards to regulations. So we need to know, are we protecting the Spring River because it's valuable for recruitment, or should we be protecting the Neosho River because it's more valuable for recruitment? And those are answers we don't quite have just yet, but all of our research aims to inform the way we regulate the species in Oklahoma and the way we protect the species as a sustainable resource for Oklahoma anglers.
We've talked a lot about the work that has gone on in Oklahoma and how these fish are very, very mobile, can travel a large distance. And surely not all of your fish are staying in Oklahoma, are they?
Well, we share the Arkansas River, of course, with Arkansas. And so that's probably our biggest river, you know, that kind of where paddlefish are going to be moving. There's even though there's dams on that system, it's a navigation channel. So there's locks, which paddlefish can do, move up and down. Most of our other rivers, you know, come to Oklahoma in a downstream direction. So Kansas, as you are well aware, I'm sure, you know, we share the Neosho River with. So in a good flood year, our paddlefish from Grand Lake, I call them our paddlefish, but I guess they're all of our paddlefish. So, but the paddlefish from Grand Lake, you know, they'll move up into Kansas, and there's probably some fairly good spawning habitat, you know, for quite a ways. So we do try to coordinate, you know, as much as we can with managers from other states and other regions of the country.
Yes, we work closely with your previous podcast guest, Ben Neely from Kansas. We've done a lot of collaborative work with him and his crew up in Kansas. Also, just to tack on to that, the idea of them being our paddlefish, that's certainly true because we collect brood stock from the Grand Lake stock, which are then used to produce progeny, which are tagged and stocked in John Redmond Reservoir in central Kansas on the upper end of the Neosho River. So those fish do eventually grow up and some of them make their way back to Grand Lake. So it's really a circular thing, and we'll detect the little hatchery tags in the rostrum of those fish, and we can track them back to their stocking date and time. And it actually contributes to our long-term age verification project, which is pretty important when you're trying to age these long-lived fish and their dentary annuli get really close together, and it's hard to tell, you know, a 15-year-old fish from a 20-year-old fish. Well, having a tag in its rostrum gives you a known age, so we're able to learn a lot from those fish that start out in Grand Lake, get stocked in Kansas, and then potentially eventually make their way back down to the Grand Lake fishery. So it's an interesting cycle.
Well, both of you have clearly demonstrated your expertise in paddlefish, but now we'll play a little game and find out which of you two is the real expert.
Oh, God.
The game is set up just like the old show Card Sharks, so I'll alternate asking one of you a question about paddlefish characteristics, such what is the largest recorded weight, and then the other will answer higher or lower. And so unlike previous versions of this game, all of these numbers were taken from the AFS publication Paddlefish Management, Propagation, and Conservation in the 21st Century. So,
I have that on my desk.
Jason, we'll start with you. What is the largest weight recorded for paddlefish?
You know, I've heard this spouted numerous times, and I almost don't even believe it. I want to say it's 200 pounds, give or take.
Adam, higher or lower?
I'm going to go with 198 pounds.
Are you looking at the book right now? I think you are.
Just looking at my memory.
So 200 pounds and 198.
Oh, well, according to the book, it was 72 kilograms or about 158.7 pounds. So Adam did guess lower, so he gets the point there.
He never said lower, technically.
All right, we'll wash that. We'll get rid of that one then.
I'm just kidding.
All right, Adam, so your turn. What is the largest reported eye to fork length for paddlefish?
Oh my gosh, I don't think I know that one off the top of my head. We'll say 1,400.
I think higher. We've never seen one that long in Oklahoma, but I think my guess is higher.
A point goes to Jason there. The largest reported eye to fork length was 2,200 or 2.2 meters.
Holy cow.
Again, that's ridiculous. That's huge.
Jason, how many states are paddlefish found in today?
Today? That's a tricky question. Adam probably knows this one.
I guess at the time that book was published.
Oh, okay. As of 2009. How many? Okay. Present and in any sort of status level.
Yep.
Man, I'm thinking like 18 or 19.
All right, Adam, higher or lower?
I'll go higher.
He knows this one.
It was 22 was what the book said. So.
Pretty close.
Yeah.
All right, Jason, what is the diameter of a fertilized paddlefish egg?
The fertilized? I've never measured that. We see unfertilized eggs at approximately 2.5 millimeters, 2.2 to 2.5 millimeters. So right. I guess my guess would be 2.5.
All right, Adam, higher or lower?
Yes, I think that's pretty spot on, but I'm going to go higher on this one.
So the book said 2 to 4 millimeters, so Jason was pretty spot on right off the bat, so we'll give him the point.
Thank you. I needed it.
We're all tied up, 2-2. What is the length of a newly hatched paddlefish larvae?
Oh, gosh, this is on my wall at work. Let's say 1 centimeter.
All right, Jason, higher or lower?
Man, you know, there's a range there, and he hit smack in the middle of it, I think. So I'm going to say higher, just because I think I was thinking 12 millimeters.
The book said 8.5 millimeters, so it was lower. Adam gets the point there.
Well, of course. All right.
Well, it turns out Adam is the real paddlefish expert.
Uh-huh.
Jason, Adam, thank you for playing along, and now we'll move on to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish? And I guess, Jason, you can go first on this one.
Well, my favorite fish, I couldn't answer anything other than paddlefish, simply because it has completely occupied my thought space for the last decade. You know, it's hard to deny they're just an amazing fish. They're primitive. They've been around for 70 million years or so. They're tough as nails. They're a survivor. They're absolutely unique in their appearance. They have superpowers like we talked about earlier. They can detect a single plankton in complete darkness and seek it out and eat it. They can migrate thousands of miles, and like we've talked about, they're a great model for some interesting research going on. So paddlefish is a pretty easy choice as my favorite.
Adam, do you have a different suggestion?
I do have a different one, and I know, Nick, you always say that these are the easy questions, but I've been absolutely racking my brain over my favorite fish for the past week or so, and I think I can honestly say that I don't have one single favorite, but I'm going to say that one of my very favorites is the shorthead red horse. It's just a fish that's sort of been around my entire life, you know, growing up in northern Indiana and fishing those rivers and living out in Montana, and now I'm in Oklahoma. They sort of just check all the boxes for me. They're a fun sport fish. You know, they're very striking fish with the bright red fins and the silvery scales. So I'm going to go shorthead red horse.
I believe that is a first for the Fisheries Podcast, so congratulations on being the first Shorthead Red Horse fan.
All right.
Adam, we'll stick with you. What is your favorite memory from your career so far?
I had to think about this one quite a bit, too, but I remember one summer I was working on the Lower Yellowstone in Montana at their paddlefish fishery, and it was a pretty slow year for, you know, catching-wise, but the river was coming up, and you could kind of tell that the next day was going to be good, so I figured I'd go out in the morning. I had about an hour before I had to get to work, you know, processing the data and stuff for recording data. And it was just one of those sort of mystical mornings on the river with a real dense fog, and it was cool, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't bitter cold or anything. And kind of just being out there in the river, and you could hardly see anybody next to you. And that's when I landed my first paddlefish. So pretty good memory for me.
And Jason, how about you? Do you have a favorite memory?
I do, and it's a little bit of contrast with Adam's tranquil snagging his first paddlefish memory. I too racked my brain on this, and what always stands out to me is, you know, the most vivid memory and probably one of those moments where I decided, okay, I'm in this fisheries thing for real, and I wouldn't be doing this otherwise, was back in grad school. You know, like you said, I worked at Arizona State University pursuing my master's studying razorback sucker in the lower Colorado River. Well, I'm out on a backwater on the Arizona side of the Colorado River, and it's in the middle of the night, and I'm running a 150-foot trammel net on a 10-foot John boat by myself in the rain with a headlamp, and it's pouring, and I'm leaning over the side of the boat trying to yank my trammel net out of a tree. And I think at that moment, it dawned on me that this is a crazy job, and I'm absolutely doing this because it's important to me to collect these data. And this, that kind of set the stage for me to say, I care about fisheries. I care about studying fish that have importance and that need managing. And that was kind of one of those awe-inspiring moments for me, not because the conditions were great, but because they were terrible and dangerous, and got me set on my way to the career I'm in now.
Yeah, for a lot of people, that might have been the straw that broke the camel's back with all those different things they had going on there. But it's led you to down a path of a pretty good career. I guess, what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
Well, it's kind of passe, but, you know, I think I'm in it right now, honestly, because, you know, I'm pretty much stationed out of my hometown. I got a big family here. You know, I really loved living and working in the desert Southwest, but always had a draw back home. And I lucked into a job where I get to work on a unique species in a program that's also unique. I have the freedom to be creative with my research ideas and endeavors. And up to this point, you know, my decisions and opinions and insights have been supported through the administration. They've been supported by my anglers for the most part. So it's kind of tough to complain. And, you know, I get to see my family as much as I want. So it's a pretty good place to be working with paddlefish in Oklahoma and getting to call my hometown of Tulsa my place of business as well. So, you know, if it all went away today, I would have to try to find something that sort of ticked all those boxes where I have the creativity and the freedoms and sort of the respect that I need to get my job done. And I have all that now, and I'm very fortunate.
Adam, how about you? What is your dream job or dream location?
Yeah, I think along the same lines of what Jason was mentioning, and, you know, in a lot of regards, I do have my dream job currently. Paddlefish are really cool in that they kind of wear a lot of different hats, you know, depending on where you're at. They might be a sport fish, or they might be a fish of special concern. So, you know, I get to do some management stuff. I get to do some conservation work. They're not always real popular, but they are quite charismatic. So I get to see people sort of go from not even really knowing or caring about this fish to, you know, really enjoying it. And as I said before, taking pride in knowing about the species and knowing that it's it's healthy and it's surviving in their area. So those are a lot of things that it's been a long road, and I've worked real hard to get here, and I'm just real happy with what I'm doing right now.
All right, Adam, if money was not an issue, what is one project you would like to work on?
So Jason and I kind of teamed up on this one, and I'll handle this first question, and then maybe for the last question, jump to Jason. But we talked about some restoration projects that we were working on with paddlefish stocking and stuff. And there's a reservoir in eastern Oklahoma called Ten Killer Lake. And historically, before the dam, it was just the Illinois River, and we've got records of paddlefish being there. But since the dam's been built, there doesn't seem to be any paddlefish there. And we did some pretty extensive netting and didn't find any fish, any paddlefish anyways. And it seems like it might be a good place for them. So, you know, none of this is in the works, but we've definitely talked about repatriating paddlefish into Ten Killer. So to me, a really interesting project would be to, on a large scale, to see, you know, what are the effects of repatriating paddlefish into a fish community. You know, how does that affect the community assemblage? You know, how does it affect the zooplankton and stuff like that? So I think that would be something really interesting to look at. But it's a large project, and it would require lots of money.
Well, Jason, Adam said you guys teamed together for these last two. So if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Yeah, Adam and I talked this out, and we have a lot in common in regards to our views on fisheries, communities, and stuff like that. And, you know, when first thinking about my answer to this question, I kind of hearken back to one of the most common questions I get when I tell people I'm a paddlefish biologist. And they're like, well, what's a paddlefish good for? And you can insert a lot of different species names in that question. And what it really comes down to is, what are fish good for? What are native fish good for? It's really easy to answer that question when you're talking about a fish that has a large commercial value or catchable value, like a trout or a largemouth bass. But then you get something that, like a paddlefish or a gar or a bowfin or a red horse or a buffalo, and people have a hard time imagining what that fish is good for. And so a principle or a concept that I think Adam and I would both like people to just have ingrained in their brains is that, you know, distill that down. Native fish communities have great value. And it's tough for me and Adam as fish biologists who put a lot of value in a lot of lesser known, lesser popular species to convince someone of that concept, because we obviously see value in the species, but someone without that background or without that education or expertise, they have a harder time seeing that without spending a lot of time with them and telling them about all these great things that species XYZ can do for the ecology or for each other. So again, six simple words: native fish communities have great value, and I hope that everyone could understand that.
Well, Jason and Adam, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It's a pleasure hearing about both of you and the work you're doing with paddlefish in Oklahoma. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Well, Adam and I are both a little bit active on Twitter in an unofficial capacity, but we like to post interesting pictures, videos, and content related to paddlefish. I'm at DirtyDog650, and Adam is at AdamBeams, B-E-A-M-Z. Other than that, you can reach us through our department website, wildlifedepartment.com, and we share some of our research presentations on a YouTube channel. If you search for Oklahoma paddlefish research, you can hear about some of the things we do through our PowerPoint presentations. It's pretty exciting.
And if you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at fisheriespod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Our guest next week is Dan Schill of the Idaho Department of Fish and Game, talking about the work he's doing on trout and carp genetics. You can download and subscribe on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 27th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, native fish communities have great value.